civic, this is a different conversation than the village corporation, but you, if you had a corporation that had subsistent land and other assets, real estate in Anchorage, owned the Chalista Hotel, owned the hotel, that you could put the hotel in a corporation, the stock of which is not restricted, and maintain restrictions on the stock which held the land, the subsistence lands.
And you issue the shares in the new shares in the new corporation to the same body of shareholders as hold the restricted stock in the existing Anchor corporation. Is that
correct? That certainly could, it's not the only way, but yeah. That
we don't want to do that, though. What I'm saying is, I think the shares of stock that I got, and I bought buildings here in Anchorage. We have apartment buildings, office complexes, and so forth in Anchorage here with that money, the stock. What I want to do is separate and continue that stock in the old company, the Kuskokwim Corporation, will hold that and move the land to another company, association preferably, and the village people or the shareholders then would have or be members automatically to the land company, land association. Now the question I would ask people here is this can be done legally, or is there restrictions on it, or what? And hopefully we can go into more depth in this, because in my mind you can do that by the shareholders' vote, majority of the shareholders, I would think.
Could I just interrupt, Glenn? I think you've gotten us to a point in the discussion that it's about time we reached. But maybe I could just suggest how we might proceed. We're going tomorrow morning to look at the AFN resolutions, because they've got these resolutions, and I think we should take a look at them and comment on them. And I should think that would be useful all round to the AFN and to everybody else. And then we were going to ask some of the people from the village corporations to speak about the way they perceive some of these things tomorrow afternoon. But let me just see if I can pursue what you've said. You say that your people, your 1,200 shareholders, have said to you, you continue to have fun with all of our money in Anchorage, and you buy and sell and do all these interesting things, but you make sure you don't lose our land. You make sure we keep our land. And you're saying, well, can't we transfer that land to, you said, cooperative and under Alaska state law held by a cooperative whose members consist of the same body of shareholders as now our shareholders in your Kuskokwim Corporation. That's one thing that perhaps some of the attorneys here would like to address. There was a little bit of attorney bashing this morning, but I think that we would all like to hear what they've got to say. But could I ask you also to consider a couple of other things? A cooperative presumably is safe from corporate failure. That is, if it isn't in business to make money and or to lose money, if it isn't taking risks, then it won't lose the land through bankruptcy. The other thing you might address is, what about taxation of lands? Are lands held by cooperatives or other entities liable to taxation? And it seems to me, I should say that many places I've gone in the state, not many places, many, many places, people have talked about IRAs. And one of the advantages, I think, they have is that land held by an IRA or by the secretary in trust is not liable to taxation. Now, that's something that hasn't even been discussed. Everybody's talking about takeovers. But it may be that in the 1990s, taxation is a subject of some consequence. So, if you don't mind my rolling all those things into Glenn's question, perhaps we might spend a little time kicking those things around. Elizabeth, I think you have the floor.
Sure. How does one get even with you? Glenn's idea of taking the two sets of assets, I want you to realize I know very little about cooperatives, so I can't talk about the merits of things being held in a cooperative structure. I just can talk about the fact that to move it from the corporate structure to the cooperative, right now there are procedures that need to be followed. It is not the majority vote, and there are dissenters' rights. And if you follow them, you can do it. There's not, you know, it's possible to be done. It is also possible, since even the discussions of people who wish the opportunity or the option of moving corporate assets from the corporate form to the IRA, and they were also in there concerned about would the benefits of the Alaska Land Bank, et cetera, track, and would the other benefits of ANCSCA, the other built-in, the present built-in tax moratorium, would they track? I believe, if I've got this right, Charlie, that one of the discussions in one of the resolutions was to make sure in the legislation, that if you wanted as a viable alternative that you were going to move assets from the present structure to another one, that some of the statutory provisions continued. Your problem is that I believe the way ANCSCA is written, that some of those provisions tend to be tied to the ANCSCA corporations themselves, or land received under ANCSCA, and once it's in the corporation, that's sort of the end of it. But you could. I mean, AFN has tried to build into their resolutions the idea that you would build in the tracking mechanism, so yes, they would move over.
Well, without anticipating what the resolutions say,
okay.
I think it helps if we understand the kind of what's out there now.
Okay.
And I didn't follow that point
right.
that you just made.
As I understand it right now, and I'm sorry I don't have ANCSCA with me so I could check, but as I understand it right now, the tax moratorium provisions and some of the Alaska land bank protections, squatters' rights being, in my view, a particularly important protection against squatters' rights, would not apply unless your land was held by an ANCSCA corporation. Now, this could be cured. I mean, that's something that could be cured.
I see. So transferring the land, as Glenn suggests, to a cooperative might not bring the land bank protection with it. Is that the point?
Yes, that's correct. But you could cure it, and there that could be handled, I think.
What about taxation of land held by cooperatives? Is it exposed to taxation by the state?
I know very little about that, so I can't comment.
David?
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot either, but I have looked at this a bit. and I, as far as I can tell, cooperatives are taxable. They're not even like nonprofits, which, if they're using the land for nonprofit purposes, I guess wouldn't be taxable under most municipal, wouldn't have property taxes, and of course they do pay income taxes. Cooperative associations, one thing to know about them is that few people know much about them because they're very unique. They are unique organizations. They kind of mix corporations and nonprofit attributes. One intriguing thing about them, I'm just going to be throwing out a few intriguing points, I suppose, is that it is possible, as probably you know, to convert a profit corporation into a cooperative association by I think it's a two-thirds vote of the shareholders changing the corporation, the articles of the corporation, from a profit corporation to a cooperative. And there aren't any dissenters' rights, as far as I can tell. You just change the form of the organization, and it becomes a cooperative. But that's only good if you're not transferring assets from one corporation to a cooperative. Once you start to transfer the assets, and of course you've got the shareholder dissenters' rights problems and the supermajority vote requirements. One thing I think is maybe implicit in this discussion of cooperatives is that they are not, and we sort of slide around on the language from shareholders to associations to members. Well, cooperatives aren't generally stock corporations. You can have stock, capital stock, issued in a cooperative. But generally, the evidence of membership is membership. It's and the good thing, I guess, or the extra that goes along with this in terms of 1991 is that it can be open to people who were born after 1971, because since there's no stock ownership, then there is no asset to which you attach, which you can dilute. The cooperative is owned by all of its members. Bankruptcy, of course, there's no protection for the cooperative against bankruptcy, as the headlines today with respect to Matanuska Maid informed us all. So as long as the cooperative is not in business, then I suppose that's true, unless its assets exceed its liabilities, or it can't, presumably it's got to have some assets in some way to make keep an office or something open. It would be subject to the same risks of insolvency as any other corporate body, which it is. But it has some intriguing attributes of both corporations and can be in business. And of course, there are cooperatives in business. But on the other hand, it is an association that is designated by membership rather than stock ownership, which accounts could be a vehicle for addressing the new native issues.
Charlie Johnson.
A question related to what Liz was talking about. Say if the protections that are in ANILCA don't track with any transfer, and say, for example, a village or any corporation right now transfers its assets. I missed part of that conversation when I was coming in. Say it transfers its assets to another body, a cooperative perhaps, and say that the village corporation gets in financial trouble. Does that also mean that you could lose, that the assets that are transferred would also be in jeopardy?
Charlie, the trick is when the asset, let's assume all the right procedures are gone over, okay, and you move the assets from the village corporation over to here, the trick is who owns this entity over here. If the village corporation continued to own it, yes, those assets could be in trouble because you would have what I would view as a parent-subsidiary relationship. Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, however, if you're doing it more along the lines that David and Glenn are suggesting, again, assuming the right procedures are followed, just because the village corporation got in trouble didn't mean the cooperative would get in trouble because they are now two separate entities because the cooperative is owned by this set of people over here. It's not owned by the village corporation.
Irregardless if it's the same set of people, you could build in those protections in a transfer of assets. Is that correct?
I think you could if you went through the right procedures in the transfer, depending on what we're doing here.
David and then Monroe Price.
Another question, though, that may come up is to what extent do you want to maintain continued control or relationships or some kind of, who's going to be in charge, is between the village corporation and the cooperative. If the cooperative controls assets that the village corporation at some point wants to use, well, they're separate, then of course you may have the problem at some point that the cooperative won't cooperate with the village corporation. But the risk is that if they're joined together, as Liz suggested, that then the assets could be at risk.
Yeah, Monroe Price and all right, Charlie.
Question: could knowing nothing about cooperatives say that the land is transferred to a cooperative or some similar? Can that conduct business with say development or a sale of the land then without getting itself into any trouble? Would it be, as you mentioned, the same jeopardy as a corporation, really the only difference being that a selected membership rather than a stock that would be that could be transferred? Is that the only benefit?
It would not be subject to a corporate takeover. They wouldn't have that risk because it would be a membership, and the takeover would have to meet the criteria for membership, and you couldn't do it.
Is that the only benefit then of say establishing a cooperative, is the ability to select the membership, whereas with stock and a corporation you cannot select membership?
Right. I mean, well, I'm not sure that's the only benefit, John. I'm not saying I know everything about these.
That's the primary one. It's like I'm beginning to understand it.
Yeah, that is one primary benefit, is that it is a membership organization instead of a stock corporation. That frees up and gets you away from the new native problem. It also separates the land from the corporation, but does not in itself protect the land. The other benefit, I guess, is, I mean, the major one, is that it seems that it eliminates the corporate takeover problem with respect to the land, because there's nothing to take over. You can't buy stock in the cooperative and take it over. And you have to qualify as a member to get into the cooperative, so Mitsubishi probably wouldn't make it. That means maybe those are the two principal benefits, and bears more looking at, perhaps.
Just Monroe, and then Glenn, and then Drew and Tony.
I'll pass.
Okay. Glenn, do you want to say something?
Oh, no. Dave answered that. What I was going to suggest to Charlie. Yeah.
Drew Hageman, did you want to get into this?
Yes, just particularly to address the issue of the David case, situation of the uncooperative cooperative. Is indeed the land bank concept an option that could be pursued that would avoid some of the issues that you've raised, David? I back up and say, when Tom mentioned this morning, the major issue confronting us is hanging on to the land. Does that hanging on to the land mean ownership, or does it mean control, or is it really a difference? Is it control or usage that we're particularly concerned about? And does a land bank help in any of those things?
Well, if you don't have ownership, then there's a real good chance you're not going to have control. So I'm not sure the two are separate. Okay. But the land bank, I suppose, gets you to some of these, protects the land. If the corporation owns the land, it's in the land bank, and the corporation has taken over, and the 10 years pass, or the 5 years pass, or the period the land is in the bank, oh, bingo, the people who've taken over the corporation now take the land out of the bank, presumably, and probably time their takeover so that it doesn't happen too far in advance the time the land becomes available. So the land bank really won't protect you from corporate takeover problems, and it doesn't do anything to address the membership. But it does give you some protection. It doesn't do anything to address the new native problem at all.
The land bank is supposed to give you protection against taxation, to put it baldly. Isn't that what?
There are three specific purposes for the land bank. For native corporations, native entities that received land pursuant to ANCSC, and that's a provision that Liz was talking about. So if you are not an entity that received land pursuant to ANCSC, and you've received it from a corporation, you don't get under those three special privileges, and that is that you are immune from property taxes for the period of time the land is within the land bank, and while it's in, you cannot develop it. You can go search for minerals and other things, but you can't develop it for other purposes. You are protected against adverse possession. Now, these three things were the reason the land bank provision was passed initially, was to protect this period of time before 1991, problems that occurred right then. Because also the taxing provision applied in the future as well, in part. Now, the third thing is that, and I don't know exactly how we manage this, but you are also protected against certain state and federal judgments. You're protected against creditors, so there cannot be some limited varieties of forced sales. So there are three protections there. They're limited. And they don't have anything. They only happen to apply to outside people who are trying to get at the assets, not through the stock holdings, but through other secondary effects.
Could I ask a question, Elizabeth, just before we go on? You say that the land bank gives you protection against seizure of the land for failure to pay certain judgments or corporate debts. Well, if when the land comes out of the land bank, the judgment is unpaid, presumably the land can be attached then.
Yes.
Elizabeth, you wanted to add something, and then we'll go to Tony Strong.
I just wanted to add that that's why, in my view, I would like to see a or at least probably for Bristol Bay, like to see a combination of use of restricted stock together with the strengthening of the land bank. Because if you have the restricted stock, you keep the control with people who are going to be evaluating how they want to use the land for their own purposes. And if the native community within Bristol Bay changes and they switch it over to some other criteria other than subsistence, then so be it. If they don't, then also so be that. But they could make, you know, decisions on whether to put things in or out of the land bank. When you're dealing with land, and some of our villages have 100,000 acres, that's a lot of land when you think about trying to police it for purposes of seeing who's trespassing, who's acquiring, accruing, I almost want to say, squatters' rights. It's a wonderful provision to reduce the burdens of having to patrol the land. And obviously, in this state, those of you who have been here a while know that there is a continuing pressure on the state legislature level for the rural areas, quote unquote, to pay their fair share of real property taxes, to the extent that 3 years ago there was a bill introduced whereby all the, unincorporated borough areas would be in effect made a mini area, I guess encompassing two-thirds of the state of Alaska, and the state legislature would function under this bill as a municipal assembly and set the mill rate, and then you would have state employees running all over the state valuing both the property out there, be it raw land or be it land that's been built on and is producing income. Now, as this state continues to change and evolve, there will be more and more pressure, I believe, at the state legislature level for taxation to be put in the bush areas, whether or not they decide to have first or second class cities. And as there is that pressure, it would be indeed a wonderful thing for the land bank or some other kinds of protections to be available so that native corporation lands, which is set aside for subsistence, doesn't have the nonsensical burden of real property taxes when you are not generating any income with which to pay it. That's the very nature of having land set aside for subsistence. And the last thing about the judgment, of course, is that's a little weaker protection because, of course, it's only if you haven't pledged the land that protection would occur. And that's a very important thing, particularly when you're dealing maybe with less sophisticated peoples.
It's a barrier against execution.
It's a barrier against execution provided you've not pledged the land.
No,
so
no.
It's for unsecured debts
yeah.
that the land bank is a protection.
Tony Strong.
Thank you. I've been enjoying this discussion, the most recent discussion particularly, and I'd hope that a lot of it would wind down so I could make some suggestions here. I've heard a lot of discussion of problems that we're heading into, I'm sure that some people have some solutions that they can suggest, but I've heard nobody make any suggestions for us to consider. And I've heard Glenn make his suggestion and a couple of them, and what I have to say, I think Tom has heard it before, so excuse me for repeating myself. I need to make a couple of observations first before I go into it. It's been published recently that about 24% of the shares that are held by the corporations in the state, the native corporations in the state, are held by non-natives already. by way of inheritance and divorce and things of that nature. So 24% of the shares being held by non-natives already, it does have an effect on the outcome of the ownership issue. I don't know where that 24% figure came from. I've read it in a recent publication.
Well, I think it's the 1985 study, but isn't it 24% of the shares transmitted since 71? It's still a sizable block.
It's a sizable block, yes. And part of my suggestion is going to address that. Part of the difficulties that I've seen people having in communities, and a lot of the communities that I've had some contact with, and I've having taught at the university in Bart and David's previous positions, I've talked about this with the students that I'd had in my classes, and that I believe that Jack had alluded to it as well, is that when these corporations were set up, when 1971 came about and corporations were authorized to be set up, and corporations were in fact set up by the village corporations and the by the villages and by the regions, what they set up was another foreign structure in the community. And what foreign meaning that they had never had experience with it before, and they had to make some adjustments. And there are some monumental adjustments that were made, and some of them were very successful, and some of them less so. I say that these structures have an effect on the outcome of the decisions that are made in the communities. I think there's a at least one or more political scientists here that might be able to address this more thoroughly. But to me, a structure that is set up for making decisions in a community, when it's developed over a long period of time, people learn to expect certain kinds of outcomes. When you submit a problem to the structure, when you submit a problem to the organization, you can expect a certain kind of outcome. But when you superimpose a new structure onto the community and submit a problem to it, that problem is going to come out with a different solution than you would expect. There are a couple, I can give you a real simple reason for it. One is that in corporations or in municipalities, the decision is often left to one individual, either the corporate president or the mayor. Whereas historically, in a lot of the native communities, the decisions were made by large groups of people, and the process for coming to the decision went through a lot of different people, so that there was some kind of consensus. By the time the solution was arrived at, there people knew what to expect out of it and had some sense that they participated in it. But when you leave the decision to one individual, they not only don't have the collective input, but they're not making decisions that are necessarily for the benefit of everybody, although they may perceive themselves doing that. I say that has a substantial impact on the community, raising levels of social dysfunction that are brought about by high levels of anxiety, not knowing what to expect from those from their organizations. Those social dysfunctions meaning higher levels of alcoholism, higher levels of self-abuse and abuse of others. And I think that there's a lot of evidence for that taking place here in the state. I've heard some people making statements here also that, let me state another problem. One of the problems that I've seen through a lot of the village corporations, on a smaller scale, a village corporate level, the size of the family has a substantial impact on the outcome of the votes. I know in Southeast Alaska that some of the village corporations, and I think this is true for a lot of the village corporations up north as well, is that those village corporations are controlled by one family. And they have historically been controlled by one family because that one family is the largest in the village. And those people who are perhaps the minority, in other words, they have enough people to get enough family members to be able to get one or two members on the board, are always in the minority, and they'll never be able to have a substantial impact on the corporate decisions. There are some members of the village who don't have enough family members to be able to get any of their family on the board. So the benefits are oftentimes accrued around the largest family. It appears that, and it appears that way both in fact, and it appears that way by people's perception. So there's higher levels of frustration that are faced by those people as well. And I've heard the argument made that land is equated to heritage. I feel that those people who don't feel like they're part of the decision making of the village, of the village corporation, or the village, just of the village corporation primarily, I think that argument is real tenuous to them. If they're looking at themselves that they don't have any voice in the corporation, the decisions of the corporation are made absent their input. They haven't gotten a benefit of any value or any of the real benefits that come from the corporation. They don't have any. I don't see them having any real desire to hold on to their village corporation stock. I think that has to be discussed a little bit more as well. All this leads into a couple of suggestions I've thought about and I've talked with some other people about, and it goes along with what Glenn had said, and I believe there were some other discussions here a little earlier. There's two recommendations that I've voiced in the past on ways of dealing with several of the problems that we've talked about. One recommendation is, and I'm glad to see there are a lot of lawyers here to be able to respond to it, because it involves a real property law issue or concept, and that is to have the stock of the corporations held in a form of life estate. Now, that's a real property issue or a real property concept that's transferred over to the stock ownership. Life estate means that they own it during their lifetime. Upon death, they transfer. I would say that the corporation would get the land or that stock back. In other words, as soon as the person dies, the corporation gets it. What is the legal term for it? The corporation gets the remainder. Yes, and then the other suggestion I had was that land. This goes along with something like that Glenn was headed into, except he was talking about it in terms of a cooperative. I think that land being held by the native governments would achieve the same kind of result. With the land being held by the native governments, you need to be able to still continue the economic force of the village corporation, and I think there's a way of doing that, and that is to have an exclusive right of development in the corporations, in the native corporations. And I think you still have to address the issue of people who do want to sell their stock. How do you address that? And I think that one of the ways that it could be done is to have the sale of the stock back to the corporation. And how do you, I mean, there are several problems that attended to that, and I really would like to have other people besides myself putting some of their thought to it. There is one other issue that I'd like this group to consider as well, and that is in the Self-Determination Act that was passed in around the same time that the Claim Settlement Act was passed, 93-638. What that act did was to confer upon the corporations tribal status. So we have a problem, or not a problem, we have a situation where a tribe has to go to a regional organization acting as a tribe, Tlingit and Haida Central Council, for instance, has to go to Sea Alaska Corporation and ask Sea Alaska to every so often pass a resolution authorizing Tlingit and Haida Central Council to be the tribal governing body for purposes of 93-638. I think you have the same situation here in Anchorage, where we have Siri Corporation acting as the tribal governing body for purposes of 93-638, and a couple of other organizations in a competitive position and reaching some levels of frustration surrounding that. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Well, that
series of interesting proposals. Could I ask you a question about the first one? You said that the stock would be held as a life estate by each shareholder. Mm-hmm. How do you get from A to B? I mean, how do we get from the point where the stock is held now as alienable in the hands of the shareholder to the point where it's held in a life estate?
Thank you. There are a lot of questions that surround it, and that is certainly one of them. There are a couple ways, it seems to me there's a couple ways to doing it. One is it may require, and I haven't really thought about this enough to say that it does require an authorization from Congress to do that. It may do that. It may be required simply on the grounds that if we look at the ownership of the stock as we hold it now, it's non-alienable. If we say that in the future, 1991, it becomes alienable and therefore it becomes vested, and to take away that vested right, we've got to compensate the individual, then it may require an act of Congress to do that. But if the stock is not considered to be vested at this point, on the reissuance of the corporation stock in 1991, you could put in that restriction. I mean, I think that there is some flexibility both in ANILCA and in ANCSA that allows the corporations to go ahead and do that even with absent any amendment. And then I'll go a little bit further in explaining that concept. Every individual who is born with whatever definition you define a native, every individual who is born a native would get issued a certain percentage of stock or a certain number of shares. If we want to go with 100 shares, that means that to me that would provide perpetual ownership of the corporations in native hands. At the same time, it addresses the issue of those people who were born after 1971. How do they become shareholders? I think that at that same time, it addresses that issue.
It's one way of converting the corporations into perpetual membership corporations. That's what you're trying to do.
Yes.
I'd like to ask Tony, in your comment about compensation for those for the transfer of or the change of the stock from as it now is to the life membership stock, would it not be true that those that might object to that kind of transfer, that kind of stock exchange, might be those that would want to sell anyway, and that the compensation might be just to buy those people out that would otherwise want to sell and or object?
That's why I recommended that kind of some kind of compensation be made for those people who would have an objection. It would be like a minority's right to what is it called here? Dissent. You know, a dissenter's right. The same basic principle would be used for that. Yes.
Can I make one more comment on? Maybe it's kind of a question, and I don't know what the answer is. Earlier, Tony, you were talking about the percentage of those that of stock that has been transferred since 71, approximately a quarter of that's gone to non-natives. And I really wonder if that's partly a definition problem, and to what extent is that a definition problem? I know in the retreats that we had to come up with the resolutions that we're going to discuss tomorrow at AFN, one of the discussed point was the blood quantum of participants in the Land Claims Act. And we had some very, interesting discussions, I guess is a good term for it, on what the blood quantum should be. And at one point, there was people that was claiming that your nativeness is not dependent on your blood quantum, and that you were a native at heart. And I guess that's fine, but how do we go back to Congress and say, let's preserve this lands for natives, but, oh, let's change it. Let's make it only natives at heart. Well, that includes a whole hell of a lot of people.
It may exclude some people who think.
Yeah, and he says it may exclude some, too. but I would really think or would like to see some
statistic somewhere, and I don't know where we're going to find them unless we do an examination of the change in stock, those transfers. How many of those transfers that are counted as non-natives are actually part native or descendant of natives?
I think an awful lot, because I find in the villages people are concerned about that. They say, my children are my children, and yet they are, do not qualify as one quarter native, so they're excluded. They may have the stock by inheritance, but they can't vote it, or they may be ineligible in any event.
Tom, I
think that's one of the problems with establishing a blood quantum qualification in any statute. I don't know if there's any alternative, but to that, now it's there. Elizabeth?
This isn't a particularly abstract answer, but as to Bristol Bay, and again, that's the only facts I really am on top of, we have right now 5,300 shareholders. Of those 5,300 shareholders, 74 are non-native. Out of those 74 who are non-native, 49, or about two-thirds, are blood-related. In other words, they're the children, the parents, or the grandchildren of the individual who died. And obviously, all the reason they're thrown into the non-native category is because they missed the blood quantum. Another 22 are relatives by marriage, and that means in-laws or spouses. And then two of them belong to other categories, institutions. So two-thirds of the non-native shareholders of Bristol Bay as of today are in the non-native category because they missed the blood quantum. And the bulk of the rest are in the spouse category and might have just missed the blood quantum or might be totally non-native, and that I don't know.
Bart?
So before we get too far away from what Monroe was talking about this morning and with the Gettys and the idea of having an interest, and it kind of coincides with something that I've thought about. So far today we are talking about the maintenance of control over the corporations and the assets by looking at redistributing assets or else perhaps putting restrictions on stock. There's one idea that may not apply, and I granted it doesn't apply to all situations, and I haven't been at any of these White Mountain meetings talking among these different people. So I'd like to see some comments if it's just totally off the wall or not. Are there some protections that may actually be provided if we loosen some restrictions within certain bounds? I'm talking about allowing stock transferences in limited situations until 1991, which will allow us to realign ownership if that's what we want to do, but within certain parameters. One thing I'm thinking about is, and it allows us to be able to find out really where the political constituency lies before 1991, because it seems to me our problem is determining what do the individual shareholders think, and that the individual shareholders have the problem because they feel like they're left out. They don't know, how in the world do I make my position known? Is it possible to allow individuals, if they want to transfer their stock to a tribal group or to a membership corporation or to a group that provides a political strength for them acting as within the body of ANCSCA? This gets around the problem of losing immediately the ANILCA protections and whatnot, because assets would still be owned by a state corporation. But you would also have the protections of having potentially a very large ownership block. Now, there's downsides to that. You have problems with maintaining one certain block of control, and also if you ask Congress, of course, to open up the stock transfer, you may not be able to open up only the small amount that you want. I know that there are downsides, but I'd like to see some discussion. There's some things that I can see it address by transferring over. Let me just get one other thing. By transferring over, you can the tribe can't, you and the tribe, or you and the membership corporation can enter into a contract to retain certain rights. That may be possible, I'm not certain. You may retain the right to dividends, whereas control goes to another group over the voting, but you have certain returns. There could be any body of things. If there's something that inherently just destroys this premise, I'd like to know, or particular downsides.
Well, one downside is the one you pointed out, that if you want to open it up for transfers before 1991, it might be hard to say the only transfers you can make are to the tribal government or a cooperative or whatever. It might be said, if this is an act of individual self-determination that you want, people should have the right to transfer to anybody, not just to the tribal group. But Bart, you had suggested earlier, I don't know if it's in your paper, that people might leave their shares by will to the tribal group. And if enough people made wills like that, that would give some indication of what people want to do. That's a form of self-determination. Is that something they can do now? Or surely you can leave you write a will now.
That's why I say, yes, we do. We have the fear that Congress will open it up to all kinds of things, but I don't see that proposition is any more obtuse than to go to Congress and ask them to stop everyone from alienating stocks. And it's true, as far as I can see, there's nothing that stops people now, elders who are leaving the earth, to leave their stock to whomever they want. They have the absolute right in their stock wills to give it to who they wish, their children, their tribes, whatever.
Yeah, Claude Dementiev.
I have a question relates to the consolidation or the gathering of shares under one umbrella, such as the corporation, or more specifically the corporation. Doesn't this allow for an easier hostile takeover for a company to go to the bank and say, look at all these shares, are all consolidated under one roof now. They're not amongst 5,000 people any longer. It's easy for us to use